through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
You know, folks, I've written so many songs, it's kind of hard to keep track of all of them. But here's one the folks seem to like, and I like it too. Here's the way it goes.
Join me, Wanda, for Howdylicious, the best in Western swing, rockabilly, classic country, and alternative twangy music, every Sunday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., only on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Get the lowdown on the publishing industry. Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She talks to anyone who's anyone in publishing. Thursdays, 5 p.m.
on KCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KCI programs, visit kci.org or kcitalk.org.
And hello, and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. And we podcast. This show will be podcast next week on iTunes, and you can find it by going to my website, which is penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of the page, and at the radio page at the top, you will see instructions on how to listen to 100-plus podcasts, many wonderful, wonderful shows, and today's show will be there as well. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have a wonderful show and a wonderful guest, Anne Hood. Anne is author of 9 books of fiction, including Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine, Waiting to Vanish, Something Blue, Three-Legged Horse, and then some books on craft, creating character emotions. Her short stories are An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, and she's also a writer of essays and short stories in such publications as Good Housekeeping, The New York Times, Ladies' Home Journal, More, Tin House, Plowshares, and The Paris Review. She's won a Best American Spiritual Writing Award, the Paul Bowles Prize for Short Fiction, and 2 Pushcart Prizes. And her new novel is The Knitting Circle, and it's published by Norton this month, actually. And we're going to particularly talk about that book and her book of short stories, An Ornithologist's Guide to Life by Norton. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to talk to you. Great to have you on. I've been aware of your work for some time, for years and years, actually. And
not too many years.
Well, not too many years, but, just long enough to realize that you are so prolific in so many different areas. And most recently, I was sent your book, The Knitting Circle, to mm-hmm. review for Pages Magazine, which I did. The current issue, the issue before, and after reading the book and loving it so much, I just knew I had to talk to you.
Oh, great. Thank you.
So talk first about The Knitting Circle and what was its inspiration?
Well, 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago now, our 5-year-old daughter, Grace, died suddenly from a virulent form of strep. And it was because it was so sudden, I think, in particular, the shock that followed that and then the settling in of that loss actually kept me from writing, the thing that in the past had always really gotten me through hard times. And it also, sadly, kept me from reading very much. And so I felt that I had lost my relationship with words, which I had had for, a very long time. Two friends took me for a walk. I think of that time sometimes as my days as a Labrador Retriever, because people would come over and walk me, And so I was being walked one day by 2 friends, and I was expressing this terrible sense of, of abandonment with words. And they said, well, do something with your hands, which actually made me laugh, because I have never been able to do anything that's remotely like a craft, And they said, go and learn how to reupholster your sofa. Well, my sofa didn't need reupholstering, but on another walk with another friend, she recommended knitting. And I don't know why, maybe just desperation, I thought, I'm going to go do that. And it became such a salvation for me, a refuge and a salvation. I started knitting, and it was something I did. One day I did it for 8 hours. I couldn't even move my fingers afterwards. It was meditative, it was healing, and since I'm a type A personality, I even had a product at the end, so it was great. It solved many problems for me. But one of the things I noticed is that I would go to knitting circles really all over. I live in Providence, and really all over Providence and all over Rhode Island. And the camaraderie that came about as women, mostly women, sat in these circles and knit. And slowly stories were revealed, and when I finally was able to start writing again, it seemed a natural thing to write about the power of knitting, the power of women, and the power of stories.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I guess I was originally drawn to the book because I'm a knitter as well, and a lot of the knitting novels I just can't find my way into. I don't know why exactly, but I just love the quality of the writing here, and loved the stories and just how deep you went with the characters and their stories, and was curious then about it being told from many points of view.
Yes, it was so interesting because when I began the novel, the structure of it came completely fully formed, which is a rare treat. You know, it's a gift. I knew that the protagonist would be told stories by many women, and that those stories would be told in first person. And when I described it to my agent, she almost had a heart attack. She said, "That's going to be really hard to pull off. Good luck." But it was actually quite easy to execute because, as you know, I love to write short stories. And each of these character stories, to me, was like a little story in itself. And they were all told in the first person. And I had so much fun writing it and learning who each of these people were and then shaping when they would each get to tell their story to marry the protagonist.
Yeah. Could you read a little bit from it so we can give listeners a taste of what we're talking about?
This is actually the very beginning of the book when Mary, who, not unlike myself, has lost her daughter. The difference here is that she lost her only child, and so she's going through a profound experience, and it's the first chapter, the beginning of the first chapter.
Okay.
Mary showed up empty-handed. "I don't have anything with me," she said, and she opened her arms to indicate their emptiness. The woman standing beside her was called Big Alice, but there was nothing big about her. She stood 5 feet tall with a tiny waist, short silver hair, and gray eyes. Big Alice had her slight body wedged between the worn wooden door to the shop and Mary herself. "This isn't really my kind of thing," Mary said apologetically. The woman nodded. "I know," she said. "I can't tell you how many people have stood right where you're standing and said that exact thing." "Well," Mary said, because she didn't know what else to say. She never did know what to say these days or what to do. This was in September, 5 months after her daughter Stella had died. "Come on in," Big Alice said. Then she added, "I guess you know I'm Alice." Mary stopped and got her bearings. These days, this was always necessary, even in familiar places. In her own kitchen, she would stop what she was doing and look around. "Oh," she would say to herself, noting that the television was off instead of tuned to Sagwa, the Chinese cat, that the bowl Stella had made at clay time with its carefully painted polka dots was empty of the cucumbers or blueberries it used to hold, that the cutout hearts with crayoned I love yous and the construction paper kite with its pink ribbon tail drooped. "Oh," Mary would say, realizing all over again that this was how her kitchen, her life, looked now. The shop was small with creaky wooden floors and baskets and shelves brimming over with yarn. It smelled like sweaters and cedar. There were 3 rooms, this small one, the room beyond with the cash register, and a well-worn couch slip-covered in a pink and red floral pattern. The yarn was beautiful. Mary saw this immediately and touched some as she followed Alice into the next room, letting her fingertips linger a bit over the skeins. "So," Alice was saying, "we'll start you on a scarf. You like this one?" "I guess so," Mary said. "You don't like it?" "I do. It's fine. It's just I can't make it. I'm not good with my hands. I flunked OMAC. Really, I did." Alice turned toward the wall and pulled down some wooden knitting needles. "A 10-year-old can make that scarf," she said, a bit impatiently. The needles felt large and smooth and awkward in Mary's hands. She watched as Alice went over to a shelf and grabbed several balls of yarn. "Which color do you like?" Alice said. "The blue, I guess," Mary said, and the particular blue of Stella's eyes presented itself to her. When she tried to blink it away, she felt tears. She turned her head. "Blue it is," Alice said more gently. "Sit down, and I'll teach you how to knit."
Wonderful. That was Anne Hood reading from The Knitting Circle, published by Norton. Now, was that always the first chapter? Was that always how the book began?
Yes, you know, I start each chapter with a little bit of a knitting lesson, and I knew right away that the first chapter had to be casting on, and so that's why I knew that would be the beginning.
Interesting. Now, living through what you lived through, losing your daughter, and writing then about it, I would imagine would be, even though this is fiction, would just be one of the hardest things. Can you talk about, taking life and turning it into fiction?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting because I think with all of the fiction that I've written, there has been the germ of something true in it. And the more you write and the more you make up, the more it becomes fiction, until often I'm the only one who knows what that germ even was. And with this, I actually couldn't write about my own experience as it happened when I began this novel. And so it was very helpful to write fiction because I could change details, make up the main characters, make up their story, the couple, Mary and her husband's story, and I could view more subjectively what I had gone through and was still going through. And slowly, by writing it fictionally, by changing things and spinning it out in ways that didn't actually happen to me, I was actually able to start writing essays about what really did happen to me. So in an odd way, the fictional story opened up my nonfiction writing.
Hmm. That is interesting. I saw a few of your pieces, perhaps on your older website.
Yeah,
I think
uh-huh.
a couple of months ago, I when I was reviewing your book, I looked for them. And how is that in terms of what becomes, because you write nonfiction as well, what becomes fiction and what becomes nonfiction? How do you know when something is an essay or a short story? How do you know when it belongs in a novel?
Yeah, you know, Eudora Welty said fiction is a lie, and I think that's exactly true. I write fiction when I'm not ready to or not interested in sharing the personal details, and when I want to change those details or change the order of events or change the ending of the story, fiction allows you so much freedom. And I write nonfiction when I feel like the true events of the story as they occurred are more interesting than anything I could change. Mm-hmm. And so although thematically there's been overlaps, especially with the knitting circle and the nonfiction I've written since Grace died, it's very clear to me when I want to tell something that really happened about that circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that seems to be... So especially when you do different types of writing, that's the hard part, is deciding what the context is for the content.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's strange. I was just teaching a writing workshop, and I said to the class that I can't write until I know my first sentence. And I have to know it exactly. If there's a comma, where that comma goes, the words, the syntax. And I often go to sleep at night just saying that first sentence and getting it right and tweaking it. And somehow when that first sentence is exactly right, the second one follows more naturally. And somehow in determining that first sentence, I understand whether it's going to be a short story or not as well, mm-hmm. or whether it's going to be an essay or not as well. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what about, for instance, with this book or mm-hmm. any of your books, how much of the book do you know? Do you know where you're going to end up?
This book has been so different than other ones I've written in so many ways. And one of those ways is that it presented itself very clearly. I was surprised by the character stories as I wrote them. They would take some twists and turns that I hadn't considered or expected. But for Mary, the protagonist, I had a very clear sense of where she would end up. Hmm. And of course, the real pleasure and interesting part for me as the writer is learning how she's going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I once had the great fortune of hearing Grace Paley give a lecture on writing, and this was before I was published, and one of the things she said that really stuck with me was, you don't write what you know, you write what you don't know about what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been something that has really guided me in my fiction writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I said, you know, you start with that germ. Well, you know what happened there if it happened to you. But it's delving deeper than you can really do when you're examining yourself and really finding out the layers and levels of what you don't understand yet, in this case about grief.
Hmm. Yeah. So were there any surprises along the way? I mean, apart from Mary, surprises in writing this book that, because it sounds like the process was a bit different from your other novels.
Yes, it was. Well, you know, I think it's a natural flow that the book is written in all of these points of view with all of these stories after I had done a collection of short stories. You know, it was sort of, I sat down writing each character story. For example, the first character you meet after Mary is Scarlett, who owns a popular bakery in town. And I thought I had her story exactly, not planned out, but I thought I understood it. And not only was I surprised in the initial telling when she tells Mary her story, but she does a few things later in the novel that I had not planned. So the characters became such unique people, which that part isn't unusual. That always happens in writing novels. You know, they just grow and grow and grow. And so I was surprised by the characters all the time writing this. I knew how the story would be told in those different voices, and I knew where Mary would end up. But writing each character every day was really a great experience.
What about the idea of characters taking over? What do you think about that?
Well, on the one hand, I think they do take over in a way. Their stories take over, but as the writer, you're always you're really the manipulator of that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think that as you get to know them, you understand the grand and amazing things that they can do. Mm-hmm. And you let them do them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is the fun part of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, Barbara, because this book was in the first draft was almost 700 pages.
700 manuscript pages.
That was because I loved each of the stories so much, and I didn't monitor that. And so they were each between 60 and 70 pages.
So what did it end up being? What did the manuscript end up being when you were done, finally done with the entire book?
I ended up cutting almost 300 pages.
Really?
Yes. Isn't that strange?
No, it's not. But it's I mean, how do you know, how did you know what to cut? Did you have readers? Did other people say, you know, there's a little too much on this one, or?
Well, I knew at one point I kind of looked down at the page number and I did a double take. I said, wow, I haven't even said all I want to say. I still have three characters waiting and I have almost 400 pages, you know. So I knew for a long time that there was going to be a lot of revising. But it wasn't the kind of revising that sometimes happens with novels and stories, actually, which is this character doesn't need to be here, or that I can get rid of the scene. It was really, everything was in place. It just needed paring down.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really sentence by sentence cutting. It was like a sculpture, you know?
Do you like revising?
Chipping away.
Do you like revising?
Pardon me?
Do you like revising?
Oh, I'm sorry. We got all static.
Oh, sorry. The revision process. Do you like it?
Oh, do I like revision?
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. I love it. I think that the part of writing that first draft when I don't revise at all, I just go. So if a character is a brunette and then I later think she should be blonde, I don't go back and change. I just keep going knowing this is so flawed.
Mm-hmm.
That process, that first draft, is exhilarating. I absolutely love it. But I think the revision process, the real getting your hands in and making your stories work, is much more rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was for many years a flight attendant, and I remember it saying to a pilot, you have the most boring job in the world. You know, everything is computerized.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I do this job for the takeoff and landings. Those few minutes, I think it's 11 minutes total, is why I do this job.
Mm-hmm.
And that first draft to me is like taking off and landing. You know, mm-hmm. it's that exhilarating. That's why you do it, because it's so such a high.
Yes.
But the revision is what makes you a writer.
Mm. Well, and it takes, I would think, well, it takes patience to allow yourself to get through the first draft knowing that so much is going to happen in the revision.
Yes, it takes denial. I try not to think about it. I just say, even sometimes I will write something and think, I think I've gone too far with this scene, or I'm not sure this character, I think it's a little outlandish, or I'm not going far enough, but I don't let it stop me. I don't think about, well, this is going to make for a lot of work you know, down the road. I just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can, because with that excitement, that's why you want to get to your computer every day, you know, or your desk every day, because it's so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And because you can do things that, even if they're not going to stay, help you understand the story and the characters better.
Yeah.
You know?
Hmm. Before we go to break, I wanted to comment on the tone of The Knitting Circle. And in reading this first and then reading the collection of stories, mm-hmm. An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, I noticed that the tone of the book, of The Knitting Circle, seemed to be different from the stories in that perhaps a more sober tone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what sort of, does the material dictate the tone for you, or do you apply tone to it?
I think the material dictates it. That's a really good question. I go back to that idea of that first sentence, coming up with that first sentence to guide me into the story. And that part of what happens in that is tone and mood get established, I think. But I wanted for The Knitting Circle a kind of sober tone, but with little dips of hope. Do you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
that there would be this balance. I mean, if the story or the tone had a shape, I almost saw it as waves.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Ah, so much more to talk about. I'm so glad you're going to be on for the next half hour.
So am I. Thank you.
All of you out there, stay with us. We're going to talk more about The Knitting Circle, but we're also going to talk a bunch about her stories from An Ornithologist's Guide to Life. So stay tuned for more Ann Hood coming right up.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI-FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And all of the shows, actually, that you hear promoed on this show can be found on our website, again, which is kuci.org. You can listen to them all online in real time, and a lot of them are podcast, as is this show. If you go to penonfire.com and click on the radio tower and go look at the top of the page, you will see instructions that will take you to the podcast page, and you can listen. You don't need an Apple computer. You don't need an iPod. You can just simply listen on your computer. I am here today with Anne Hood. She's author of many books. The ones we are talking about today are The Knitting Circle and An Ornithologist's Guide to Life. Her website is annhood.us. Let's bring her back on. Hi there.
Hi, Barbara.
Oh, so much more to talk about. Let's talk a little bit about, as we segue into your collection of short stories, curious about a little bit more about fiction versus, short stories versus novels.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know when an idea comes that it's going to be a short story? And how do you know when it's going to be a novel?
You know, I wish I could answer that. It would be helpful, wouldn't it? They present themselves so clearly. When I have an idea for a short story, I just see it. I see it in a contained way. That's a terrible answer, but that's the only way I can describe it. I can picture it. I can see its shape. I can understand its trajectories. When I start thinking about, when I get an idea that just seems so vast that the shape or where its trajectories are so distant or blurry, I know it must be a novel.
So when you say you can see the shape of a short story, does that mean that you pretty much see the characters involved, see the problem, and see the resolution?
Yes, in a sketchy way. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I understand. For example, that this is a teenager who is going to discover a secret about her mother.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, I can state it that clearly. Now, the details of it and how the story unfolds, that's part of the process.
Yeah.
But I know that that's what it's about. And a novel, when I begin it, I could never state something that clearly about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there's subplots and complications and probably a large cast of characters that are going to take a lot more working out.
Yeah. Do you, when you write a short story, these short stories, for instance, in this book, is there always one character that you can relate to more than any other, or are you in a little bit in all of them, or none?
Yeah, that varies from story to story. I think I'm always, there's always at least one piece of me in there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Sometimes my adult self I put in a teenage body, or, you know, I mix it up so that it's not always identifiable, but I'm always in there a little. And sometimes I'm a lot of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing in reading these, what I noticed and what I liked so much was that, and after I read a couple of them, I realized that the endings were not going to be predictable.
Mm-hmm.
That you really, you come up to the ending, and just, I would say every story actually had a surprise ending for me. The one called The Language of Sorrow, mm-hmm. of course, that ending with, you know, the tattoo,
yes.
was such a surprise. And so, I mean, so many of them, the next to the last story too, what was it called? Let me see. I have it right here. Marjorie's story.
New People.
New People.
Mm-hmm.
That, the ending to that, talk about that story right now. About, you know, the ending, did you know that was going to be the problem with these little girls and the husband?
Yes, that story, I knew exactly what I was really telling, and the challenge I had for myself was to bury that and place clues in the story. I love doing jigsaw puzzles, and to me, the story was like a jigsaw puzzle.
Hmm.
You know, I wanted all of the pieces there, but I didn't want them to fit when you first looked at them. And so I actually had a wonderful time writing that story, because every scene and much of the dialogue, actually, for me, there were two things going on, because I was trying to get that other story told as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story that's revealed in the end.
Yeah,
I'm being a little coy because I don't want to reveal
right,
it.
Right, right.
You know, but yes, I knew there were two stories operating there.
Mm. And, gosh, I mean, we could go through every one in here. Because they are all just so incredible.
Thank you so much.
One thing I wanted to talk about in terms of this collection, and also the Knitting Circle, and, mm-hmm. and now I'm, you know, looking for your other books because I must read them all, is Providence is a setting in most of the stories, and certainly in the novel, and I understand that you live there.
Yeah.
Talk about place as setting and setting's role in your fiction.
Oh, yeah. Setting to me is one of the most important elements in the craft. And it's one that I think beginning writers often neglect, not understanding its importance. And so it's easy to say, well, I live in Providence. I think I'll just place this story in Providence.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think very hard about setting before I write. And if it's convenient for it to be in Providence and I can use landmarks and, you know, work on things and use them as metaphors, and they're right in my backyard, that's great. But that isn't always the case. One of the stories, the one called Joelle's Mother,
yes,
it takes place in Baltimore, a city I don't really know that well,
mm-hmm.
but I visited it around the time that the story takes place, which is in the 70s, and it just left a certain impression on me, and it fit what I wanted for this story. The city that was a little bit run down at that time, but surrounded by suburbs, to sort of juxtapose the two lifestyles the story talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And in the title story, An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, I set the story in Park Slope in the 70s. Park Slope is part of Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
which now is pretty gentrified. But in the 70s, the first time I went to Park Slope, just as I describe in the story, all of the houses were in disrepair. And that story is about really families falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just seemed so perfect to use these beautiful brownstones with all these hidden secrets.
Yeah.
So to me, those settings became important metaphors to the stories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, which was the last story, I remember reading it. Well, actually, I finished it today, and I remember sitting there and then thinking about all of these stories, and again, the endings of these stories.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them are vague in such a pleasing way. There's, you know, where it's going, what's happening, but It's not spelled out. And I wonder if you would just talk a bit about crafting endings, because endings are one of the hardest things, I think, about writing fiction.
Oh, and they're the hardest things to write for short stories, I think.
Yes.
Because the weight of them is so important. Well, I don't like a tied-up ending, you know, a nice resolution, because I like my stories to be more lifelike. And those tied-up endings are so rare in real life. And I want the stories to reflect the beginnings or possibility of change, but not necessarily let you know exactly how that change could manifest.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good short story, the reader isn't saying it's either going to be this or that at the end. She's either going to leave him or stay with him. She's either going to keep her job or get a different job. It has to be that there are infinite possibilities for that character. And I think if you've written a good short story, the ending is almost always a surprise because there wasn't an either-or situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's many ways. If the character is complex enough and the situation is dynamic enough, that combination just allows for the story to go in so many directions. And so I will admit to you, though, that the title story, An Ornithologist Got to Life, ended in the present day at one point when the protagonist, who is an adolescent in the story, I shot ahead, you know, 30 years and put her at a cocktail party where she ran into other people who had minor roles in the story.
Mm.
And I was in a writing group at the time, and they just said, cut it here.
Hmm.
And we don't need, although, you know, they thought the scene was kind of interesting and fun, it did not serve the story.
Right.
And the first short story in the book, Total Cave Darkness, which appeared in the Paris Review, they accepted the story for publication, and then I got a call from George Plimpton, and he said, I want to cut the last 5 pages. Is that okay with you? And you know, after I caught my breath and picked myself up off the floor, not only about cutting the last 5 pages, but because I was talking to George Plimpton, I said, well, let me look at it and get back to you, you know. And I looked, and again, he was exactly right that I had pushed the ending too far.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that sense, I think, of the ending not being tidy has to do with having written it perhaps tidily. And then pulling back.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear you read from one of them.
I thought I would read from the one I was just talking about, Total Cave Darkness.
Sure.
The reason being that this story was one of the few stories that came to me almost perfectly formed, except for those last 5 pages that don't exist anymore, because it came to me like a voice. The rhythm of the story was so clear and contagious, and I just heard, I'm going to read it, the very beginning, but this first paragraph came to me just as it is right now, you know, as it remained. So,
okay.
And Total Cave Darkness.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Ann Hood, who's about to read from the first story in An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, published by Norton.
He calls her sweetheart, darling, honey pie. Martha calls him Reverend. Even now, as she watches him stretch out on the hood of his car, shirtless, smiling to himself, face turned toward the blistering July sun, Martha thinks, the Reverend is so damn young. The payphone is hot against her ear, and she smells someone else's bad breath emanating from it. Martha is sweaty from heat and humidity, sore from too much acrobatic sex, and she wants a drink. God help her, she wants a cold beer, a chilled white wine, a vodka and tonic, anything. 600 miles from this parking lot, Martha's mother answers the phone with a weary hello. Massachusetts is in the middle of a heat wave, too. Martha knows this. In between sex and free HBO, she watches the Weather Channel. The whole country is hot. It's me, Martha says with forced cheerfulness. I'm about to go into a cave, so I figured I should check in case you never hear from me again. You know. Her mother lowers her voice as if the phone could be tapped. A cave? Is that all you have to say for yourself? Then there is a silence in which Martha hears her mother thinking, "You have done crazy things in your day," but running off with a priest tops them all. The Reverend lazily wipes the sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand. He is 9 years younger than Martha, with startling green eyes. He's not a priest, you know. He's a minister, Mom, a Protestant. "What did I say? Did I say anything about it? I don't care what you call him," her mother is saying. "He wears one of those little white collars, doesn't he? He gets up on Sunday mornings and preaches to people, doesn't he? What are you thinking? You're a grown woman, Martha, over 40, and you take off with him for 3 weeks. 2, almost 2, Martha says. "And everyone knows the two of you are not off praying together." Her mother's voice grows weary again as she repeats, "What are you thinking?"
Thank you so much. That was Ann Hood reading from the first story in An Ornithologist's Guide to Life called Total Cave Darkness. One thing about your writing that I notice in all of the stories, all of your work, is there's a certain compassion that seems to be apparent, that is subtle, but that is apparent that you, the author, has for all of the characters.
I don't know if
you're aware of that when you're writing, or if that's even important to you.
It is important, and I'm so happy to hear you say that. It's very important to me, though I don't do it consciously. You know, I think it's my view of the world and of people. And that's why it comes across. Someone in a review once said that I was very human, and I really liked that idea because that is important.
How important do you think are sympathetic characters? You know, every so often, one of my students or one of my author friends will say, "Oh, this agent, that agent, they don't like it because they say the characters aren't sympathetic."
Mm-hmm.
And they go, "But they're real," but the agent says they're not sympathetic.
You know, I think empathy is what you want, empathetic, not sympathetic. You have to be able, with even someone who seems like a bad person or is incredibly flawed, to say, "I have felt that way too," for the reader to be able to identify with that character on some level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's why we still read Shakespeare and care about, the bad guys care about Hamlet or care about Macbeth, because they are dramatizations of things we actually feel ourselves. And so for me, it's about empathy. In that story, again, the one that I just read from Total Cave Darkness, the woman's an alcoholic. And I really wanted to write a story in which a woman just wants a drink. That's what she wants. She wants to have a drink. And all of the issues of love and life and caring and relationships aren't as important to her as wanting that drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't a very likable person.
Right.
But I think that's an empathetic person.
Mm.
And so that's what I strive for.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And I do think that's what people mean when they say they're not sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that really they're lacking empathy.
Yeah. I'll tell you, one of the funniest stories in this book for me was Lost Parts. I found myself laughing out loud at the story, which, I suppose it shouldn't be funny, because in the beginning, a woman accidentally kills her boyfriend in a car accident.
Her boyfriend she wants to break up with.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there laughing in this story. Will you talk about this one and where it came from and how it was to write?
Well, you know, I loved writing that because it was one of those things where I was, you know, in a relationship and angry and
I guess so.
A little fantasy crept in, and then I realized, oh, that would be terrible. And then, you know, I went a step further and thought, but everyone would think I felt so bad, like they wouldn't know I'd had, you know, little fantasy. And I started kind of laughing out loud myself, but I thought, well, it's an interesting dilemma, and surely it has happened. And so I wrote the beginning, and then that story is one of the ones that grew and grew in completely unexpected ways. But I loved exploring the idea of guilt. And I loved exploring the idea of alienation because she can't say, I was going to break up with him anyway. So she has to kind of be the grieving girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does to her and the places it takes her. I was completely fascinated with the situation that I created.
Mm. Yeah.
And a little guilty about why I created it.
Well, this, you know, this collection really is, would be a great study for somebody who wants to write short stories.
Thank you.
Just, you know, how it's done, because so much of good writing really comes from good reading. And I find lately I lose patience with short stories, and I really haven't been reading them very, very much at all. And this book, I was so happy to, because I love the form, I was so happy to just be sucked in and want to stay with it.
Oh, thank you. And I love the form, so that's a real compliment. Thank you.
What else? Gosh, so much else, and we have about 4 minutes left. Are you ever worried in writing that people are going to think, that readers are going to think it's you, that your family's going to wonder what's wrong with you, that your kids are going to be upset? Do you ever think about that, or do you just figure, you know, this is my work, I have to do this, and it'll be okay?
It's a little bit of both. I have found that no matter what I write, somebody, usually somebody who did not influence it at all, believes that they did. They'll say, oh, you know, I noticed you, that character who does this and that, and I told you that story about, you know, what I did, and that never occurred to me, and I, you know, here's why I made it up and where it came from. So people find themselves in it, which I think is actually a good sign, because it's a sign that maybe I'm doing something right if somebody can identify with, you know, a story or a character. When I write the nonfiction, I worry more about treading on someone's personal, you know, personal life or inclination. And I know people who write nonfiction always say, but it's my point of view, so that makes it okay. But I think you do have to be a little more cautious or aware that other people are, you know, being exposed.
Yeah, yeah. Does it ever influence what point of view you write in? Do you write certain stories in, say, third person, because you know it's going to be less of the I, so that, or none of the I, so that people can't say, well, you know, it's autobiographical.
Oh, you know, yes, sometimes, although, you know, it's very hard to write in first person, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to write in third person. And so, and maybe that's why. Maybe I like that distancing. You know, if you write in third person, it stops being you, the writer, anyway, even to yourself, not
mm-hmm.
only to others. But
sure.
It's a way of keeping, you know, just the facts in and letting your imagination, which is what fiction should be, I think, you know, ultimately. I always liked Tim O'Brien's that you don't tell the truth, you tell the emotional truth,
mm-hmm.
and you change everything else.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think of it as you know, the stage, like you're changing all the props, hopefully to get across the emotional truth instead of the details of something real,
mm.
that, you know, that really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think third person is a step in that direction where you can, it's not you anymore, it's this person, and then they're older or younger. Like the one you mentioned about the tattoo,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was told from the point of view of an older woman. You know, she's in her 70s and a grandmother. And that little seed I talked about at the beginning of the first half hour was there. That part, that started out being something I did and something I thought and felt, and pretty soon it was this woman's story, and everything about it was different except the emotional truth I was trying to convey.
Hmm. Interesting. Oh, and we're at the end of our time. Do you have any words of wisdom for the writers listening?
It went so quickly.
I know. It went too quickly.
It really did. You know what? You said it, and I say it all the time to writers, read. War, that's how you learn how to write.
Mm.
Read everything and read some more.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I would love to have you back on, perhaps when your book comes out in paper or your next book or whatever.
It would be a delight. I hope so. Thank you,
Barbara. So much more to talk about. And best of luck with this book and all of them.
Thank you.
You're
talk to you again.
Welcome. That was Anne Hood, author of The Knitting Circle, author of An Ornithologist's Guide to Life, author of seven other books of fiction, and so worth taking a look at. And I am looking for other books. because I'm a fan and I have to read them now. Just love the writing and love her take on things. We'll podcast this show next week if you want to re-listen or tell others. Also, if you want to know more about the show, go to penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a little quote by Tobias Wolff, who said, "A novel invites digression and a little relaxation of the grip, because a reader can't endure being held that tightly in hand for so long a time." Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.